An ordained minister has decided to give up God for a year.
How the heck do you just up and become atheist after being a pastor?
What I'm most worried about right now is figuring out how I can live openly and honestly.
I am finally free to be me.
I have no idea how to find friends or become a part of a community that's not religious.
What does life look like after church, after religion, after God?
That's it in a nutshell.
This is the Life After God podcast, a conversation on the space between belief and unbelief and beyond, with your host, Ryan Bell.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to the Life After God podcast. This is episode 95, and as I'm recording this segment on November 7, 2020, Joe Biden has just been projected to be the 46th president of the United States, unseating the aspirational fascist Donald Trump and preventing his second term. My guest on this episode is my friend, fellow secular American and pollster, Juham Navarro Rivera. But before we get to that conversation, I can't resist sharing a few thoughts about this election. I think it's fair to say that secular humanists around the world are at least relieved and perhaps even elated by Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's historic victory. Donald Trump has been a scourge on our nation and a threat to the life and safety of millions of people worldwide, and especially those who call the United States of America home. He absolutely needed to go. LGBTQ folks, Black, Indigenous, and other people of color, non-religious folks, and the poor and working class will all have a better chance to fight for what they need and deserve under a Biden administration rather than under another Trump administration. That said, a Biden-Harris White House is a long way from guaranteeing the conditions for human and planetary flourishing. The Democratic Party managed to retake the Rust Belt states of Michigan and Wisconsin that Hillary Clinton narrowly lost, and will probably flip Arizona, if not Georgia, as well. At this moment, we don't have a definitive decision in either state, and Georgia is headed for a recount, according to state officials. So it'll be some time there before we know who the winner is, but we know that Biden has enough electoral votes at this moment to be named the next president of the United States. Democrats did not experience the blue wave they were predicting. Polling was once again way off in the direction of Democrats, creating again a very tense week for everyone. Democrats didn't retake the Senate, even if both Georgia seats go to the Democrats in the runoff, and they've lost at this hour 6 seats in the House when they predicted expanding their lead. So I think some sobriety is in order as we celebrate the removal of Donald Trump, and yet it is still a huge relief. So where does this leave us? Well, it leaves us with a neoliberal executive branch, a divided Congress, and a very right-leaning Supreme Court. What that really means is that we have to keep doing what we've been doing, which is building mass movements in our cities and towns, mobilizing in the streets for human dignity. Record numbers of people are being diagnosed with COVID-19 as we stare down a third wave this winter. Eviction moratoria are expiring in a few months in the dead of winter, and hundreds of thousands of people face eviction. Hundreds of children who sought asylum with their parents here in the United States and were separated from them at the border have not been reunited because they can't find their parents. All the crises remain. The kinder, gentler capitalist party will soon be in charge, and we must continue to fight for our freedom and dignity. Still, I have felt the relief of this election result in my body and in my mind today. The mainstream media had already called it for Biden before I woke up this morning, and it was one of the first notifications I saw on my phone as I peeled my eyes open. At first, I was nonplussed. For one thing, I had already determined for myself that this would be the outcome, and for another, I'm definitely not a Biden fan. So I felt like, okay, good, but I wasn't in a celebratory mood at all. But as the day has gone on, I can't deny this feeling that a huge burden has been lifted. I feel a little less anxious, a little more hopeful. Trump has never had a majority of Americans who support his brand of neo-fascism. He is ineffectual and ill-tempered. We lucked out in that regard, I feel. After watching the news this morning for a few minutes, Brooke started cleaning the house. I got up from what I was doing and started working with her. Before long, we had swept and Swiffered our wood floors, vacuumed the carpets, dusted the furniture, and straightened the whole house. I asked her, when we were done, if she thought it was consciously or even maybe subconsciously related to the Trump defeat, and she said, without a doubt. We may not have a clean slate, but it's better than the horribly polluted one we've had for the last 4 years. It's fine to feel however you feel about this election, and I'm sure my feelings will evolve and change in the coming days. This show is made possible with the generous support of listeners like you. Another enormous thank you to the members of the podcast who support the show from month to month. You are my heroes, and I'm so tremendously grateful. I fit this work in around my day job at the Secular Student Alliance and my local organizing work. Your support for this is what makes it possible. If you haven't signed up to support the show, today is a great day to do it. Just go to patreon.com/lifeaftergod. You can pledge any amount, whatever you think it's worth. There are also a number of things you can do that are completely free. You can share this episode on your social media. You can rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts, and you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. You can learn more about Life After God by visiting our website at lifeaftergod.org. From there, you can follow us on social media, subscribe to our newsletter, and check out our extensive back catalog of episodes. You can also write to me at ryan@lifeaftergod.org. I love getting email from listeners, and I look forward to hearing from you. As I mentioned earlier, my guest today is Dr. Juham Navarro Rivera. Juham is a political scientist, writer, public speaker, and research consultant. He is the founder, political research director, and managing partner at Socioanalytica Research, and a senior fellow at the Institute for Humanist Studies. He has extensive experience working with research organizations including Pew, PRRI, and others. So we recorded this conversation about a week ago, before the election. So towards the end, you'll hear me ask Juham to make some predictions about the outcome of the election. I hope you enjoy finding out whether Juham has predictive powers greater than that of Nate Silver. Our conversation is based around a recent report from Socioanalytica Research entitled Secular Voices Survey. You might want to have the report we're discussing available as you listen to this episode. The link to that report and other items we discuss in this episode are in the show notes. Okay, let's get to this conversation with Juham about the political views of secular Americans. Juham Navarro Rivera, welcome to the Life After God podcast.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's
you,
great.
You interview many of my friends, so
I'm so sorry that it's taken this long. You know, it's I say this almost every episode, but this is way overdue. But I'm glad we're finally doing it. Thank you, in part, to Sarah Henry.
Yes, yes. Thanks to Sarah. And yeah, it's been a year in the making, I think.
Yeah, it's embarrassing to admit, but yes.
Don't worry. I mean, story of life.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so let's start by just talking a little bit about your sort of your personal history with respect to, I guess, your you know, your academic pursuits as well as like your personal beliefs and kind of how you ended up where you ended up today, which is as the founder and principal of Socioanalytica Research. We'll get into the work that you're doing in a little while, but in just a few minutes. But tell me a little bit about your personal background and kind of how you got to this point.
Yes, so I grew up in Puerto Rico. I was born there and lived there until I finished college. So you know, like I moved when I was 21. So I've been essentially half my life here now in the States. And you know, I went to, like, as I call it, the most boring story ever told, in terms of like deconversion and stuff like that. my life as a religious person wasn't very long, and it, you know, I was baptized Catholic. I don't have memory of it because I was like a few months old,
right?
as many Catholics are. And, you know, I went to religious school. So I went to like a Disciples of Christ elementary school that was near my dad's garage. Like he had back in those days an auto repair shop. And right. then I went to two Catholic schools, including a Catholic high school where I graduated and I loved, like, you know, it closed actually, but it was an amazing experience. very good left wing kind of like liberation theology kind of teachers that were fired the next year.
Oh my gosh.
After I graduated. Yeah, like the, you know, my brother graduated from there a few years later, and it was a very different school, like very conservative by that time. So, you know, I was very lucky being in that environment with those teachers who like encouraged like free thought and just like, you know, I was a little, I wasn't a class clown because I was like in the, you know, what you call it now, gifted kids kind of stuff.
Oh, right.
So, you know, like there was no class clown per se in that class. So I was the closest thing to what they had, mostly because I was very reverent about church things and whatnot. So it I think in some ways it was very predictable the way I ended.
Yeah.
Not very respectful of religion. I think a lot of people become atheist, in my case. It wasn't because of like, you know, science or anything like that. It was more about looking at relationships of power and always being very suspicious of religious people and like these leaders and what was the source of their authority. After that, I went to, so after that, after I finished that high school, I went to the University of Puerto Rico, which was my dream. Like, you know, that's a historical campus, in San Juan, the section called Rio Piedras, history of student upheaval, like a lot of activism. So, you know, I major in political science. And I loved it. Those were like four amazing years. I still love them. I still remember them fondly. And while I was there, I wasn't particularly the best student. I didn't attend many of my classes my first 2 years. There was too much to do there, like too much learning to do outside of the classroom. But I was able to graduate with honors, like applying my last 2 years. And I got the attention of a few professors. One of them who like, you know, took me under his wing, and I ended up like shipped after graduation to a PhD program, in political science in Connecticut. And after that, I was burned out. So I, after 2 years, I dropped off the radar, went to work, started like working on public health and doing stats work. And it was, you know, like that's the thing I caught up in college with this professor was like a lot of, learning how to do a statistical analysis. And after a few years, I got kind of tired and I wanted to go back to school. A lot of my colleagues were PhDs and they were getting like academic jobs and they were like encouraging me to go back to get finish my degree. So I went back to the University of Connecticut. By that time, the person who was my advisor was the department chair. So we got everything ready for me to get back to the department. And that was in 2007. And that's the year where I ended in like the secular stuff. Mostly because I am like, we get an email. The department gets an email from Trinity College in Hartford, looking for a research fellow at this newish Institute for the Study of Secularism in Society and Culture, to work with Dr. Barry Cosman and Dr. Ariella Kesar, who were doing like some research on non-religion and whatnot. And one of my friends tells me, like, this is right down your alley. Because I did a lot of stuff on religion, but we didn't really have religion as either a major at Connecticut or the University of Puerto Rico, and no experts on religion in our department. So, you know, I applied, and I was in Washington, D.C. doing an internship at the U.S. Census when, like, I get the call. So I interview in Connecticut, like I meet Barry and Ariella, we hit it off the same, you know, the first day. And so I started that semester of 2007. First thing we're doing is like prepping to getting the field, the American Religious Identification Survey for 2008. And so, you know, we got some reports, and then like in 2009, we finally released the survey. We were like most of 2008 fielding it. You know, now you can get amazing tons of data, survey data, quickly thanks to online surveys. Like, that was a steal. Not a thing for reputable surveys in 2008.
So, yeah, everybody.
We had to go to the old school phone surveys. And, you know, it was an amazing experience. That's how I learned about the movement, because we released the survey in 2009. We like have this number of the knowns are 15% of the population. And like, you know, we ran with that number, that's what puts us in the map. Not just the institute, but also the knowns. And so, you know, we start getting requests from like the different organizations in the movement to get like, you know, some deeper detail. So we ended up doing a second report, which was just about the knowns, which is still like up to this day, the work that I'm most cited for that I have published. And so, you know, that's how I became aware of the movement. By that point, I was already an out atheist. But I really didn't know. So I was like, you know, a known with, you know, no organizational grounding or anything like that. And I think that it remains that the case until 2012. There's an opening at PRRI, the Public Religion Research Institute, with one of your recent guests.
That's
my
right.
Ex-boss, Robbie Jones.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like at that point, like PRRI was mostly a two-person operation. Robbie and Dan Katz. And so they were actually hiring the first researcher out of them. That wasn't them. And so I applied, and, you know, Barry Cosman and Mark Silk were my main references, and, you know, they knew the work of the American Religious Education Survey. So I ended up moving to DC without finishing my PhD. and working with them, like, you know, I got involved in a bunch of different projects. But now moving to DC meant I started getting more involved with the other organizations that now are based in DC. And I think, you know, now I've been in DC for 8 years, and I have tasted all of them. And so my journey ended in the American Humanist Association. I think fits better the way I am right now, in my journey, which went like from like maybe 2003, 2004, new atheist kind of face, lots of Dawkins, Harris,
anti-religion,
Hitchens, to like, you know, right now, no, like, I don't want to read about those guys. And I'm actually in the move, we have to get rid of books, so like those were the first to go. even at a level of personality speaking, I really like how the people at AHA received me. I would say like the two best experiences I've had in organization have been with the Washington Ethical Society, which I'm kind of like an ad hoc member because it's too churchy for me, the Ethical Society, but I do like them.
Yes.
And AHA in terms of an organization, and like, you know, I eventually met Roy Speckhard and ended up now in the board of directors, have been since 2019.
I voted for you as a member.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I know of two people who voted for me other than me and you.
That's right.
Nice to know. So that has been my journey, kind of like my scholarship, like, you know, my involvement in all these religion knowns kind of research led me to find the movement. And so it wasn't the other way around. Although I was already like an atheist by the time I was doing the research. And that was led me to ICCC, like, you know, that interest in non-religion, particularly among Latinos, because I was surprised about the number of non-Latinos that Latino knowns that we found in that survey was 12%. Now it's about 25. So I'm really, I realized I wasn't alone.
Yeah. And people must categorize. And I guess now we're getting into some of the sort of the meat of the work you've been doing lately with your new organization that you only started, I think, what, a year or two ago?
Oh, 3 years ago.
Three. Wow. Time flies. Socioanalytica Research. Look it up, folks. We'll put the link to everything that Joam's doing in the show notes. But I just did an interview with Victoria De La Torre here in San Diego about the Secular Day of the Dead, and we started talking about the way that Latinx communities relate to religion. And I suppose, and this is where I always get confused by research data, you know, because it's self-reporting, right? There's no empirical measure of whether a person is religious or, I mean, I guess there is if they go to church that you could say that that person's religious, but you're not standing outside of church, like writing down how many people go. You're relying on people self-reporting that they go to church or they don't, or they have other practices like prayer or reading the Bible or, I don't know, meditation or crystals or whatever they do. And I wonder for especially Latinx communities, whether they think of themselves as religious, even if they're not very religious, if that makes any sense.
It makes sense. I think there's that stereotype of the Latinx person as being religious. I think it comes two ways. I think one is this assumption that everybody's Catholic.
Right.
You know, that
or Pentecostal,
the, you know, like the Catholic Church is like, you know, huge. Well, not as huge as it was like 100 years ago, but certainly still huge in many places in Latin America. And so definitely that's part of the assumption that we're Catholic, and if we're not Catholic, then we're Pentecostals.
Right.
Who were Catholic.
Who were Catholic, yes.
and that is not the case. Latinx people have been from the beginning of the Pentecostal movement, part of the movement.
Mm.
So there's like generations of Latinxes who have never been Catholic.
Right.
And so that's one. And second, it's that because being Catholic is such a normal thing, or it's being seen as a normal thing, means that a lot of people leave, but they don't announce it. I mean, I think my experience is pretty typical of a Catholic who is now not religious. It's like, you know, we did the rites, like, you know,
yeah,
got baptized, or like, you know, maybe people got married in the church, but they didn't go to church after that. Like, you know, they just did those ceremonies, not necessarily because they were Catholics, but because it's the thing that people do
in the culture and in the community.
Yeah. And so, but I think to a large extent, a lot of people, I like to say that when we unveil these numbers of the knowns, I think what happened is that people start getting honest rather than leaving religion. And that a lot of people now don't, like, now it has become so entrenched in the culture that people are not afraid of saying anymore that they're not religious.
Right, yeah, the halo effect has gone away a little bit, where they feel a little bit ashamed, and so they're going to say they go to church three times a month, but really they only go, like, three times a year.
And we shouldn't underestimate the effect of two forces, especially in the United States, of, like, you know, white evangelicals, like, giving this name to religion that people want to run away from.
Mm.
And then within the Catholic Church, all the abuse scandals of, like, the, you know, the 1990s, early part of the century.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a way, a lot of people have been not happy with those identifications. And so it makes sense. I mean, if you see in general, not just Latinx people who get less attention in terms of who are leaving, but I mean, a bunch of the knowns, if you look at the former religion, it's a bunch of former Catholics. And in the Aries, we did like one batch of like a subsample, and we asked them about their ethnic origin, and like it was full of Irish and Italians. So you get that shortcut.
Right. So that this kind of, I guess, is getting a little ahead of ourselves, but just backing up for a second, we're talking about, you know, through the lens of, since you mentioned your own background being Latino, sort of through the lens of Latinx people, we've been talking about what is secular, really. And so I want to back up and just basically ask you that question, because in the report that you just recently released, you really do start by like defining some terms, and it's a pretty broad category, the secular people. Who do you include in that, and how do you determine whether a person fits into that category?
Yeah, so that depends how the question is asked. So in the case of the question that I'm using a modified Pew version, mostly because Pew has like this long list of religion, which is not religions, it's this long list of Christian denominations.
Right. And then a few other religions.
And then like atheist, agnostic, nothing in particular. So I kind of like did a modified version of that because I wasn't going to have that huge a sample. So I just decided to like get some main Christian categories like Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox. And then I knew I wasn't going to get enough not Christian religious people. So Jewish, Buddhist. So I actually created like a bucket for that. And then people open-ended gave it that to me. And then atheist, agnostic, and nothing in particular. Those were like the three categories that people who answered those three are essentially the secular. I define it as secular because I using the term known is kind of like weird in a report.
Yeah, the nuns, it was almost like a placeholder, and it's always been begging for more analysis.
Yes. Yes. So, and the reason we used nones in 2008, 2009 was because it had been used in the previous iteration of the Ares. We kind of like had that story just going.
For those that maybe don't know, what is Ares?
Oh, the American Religious Identification Survey.
Right. So that comes out every year.
It was the third time it was conducted.
Okay. How often is that done? Is it on a regular cycle or just kind of whenever they decide to do it?
No, it was on the cycle of You Got Money for it.
Exactly. So what is the difference? I'll sort of go into a footnote here and ask a question about methodology. How does your sample size compare to the other large research organizations? And let me just start with that.
So, yeah, so my sample is about 2020, I think. 2020 and 2020.
2020,
or something like that. I think it was 2019, but it wasn't that ballpark. And, you know, I compared it with particularly the PRRI, which I have very good relationship with them. Mm-hmm. And it's in the same ballpark, okay. Especially after you go with weighting. And this is one of the things I've been finding, that phone surveys, like most of the PRRI samples or Pew's, although Pew has now some online samples, or the comparative congressional electoral study, that it's online. Like online samples, you get a higher proportion of non-religious, and that kind of like gets weighted down. So I got about 29% non-religious sample. So with the weights, because of course being an online sample, it's like an excuse a little younger. So with the weights, it goes down to 26, which is what PRI has right now.
Okay.
So it's in that same ballpark.
I'm always amazed that you can extrapolate to an entire nation the size of the United States from so few people, but I don't pretend to understand statistics.
You have to do some math, it's doable.
Yeah.
If you have a good method, a good method of comparison, or as my old college professor would say, just get a lot of people and you're going to get closer to the real number.
Right.
The more people you have.
Right. So you found that, basically 26% or just over a quarter of Americans identify in some way as secular, either atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular.
Yeah.
And that most of those, two-thirds of them, are nothing in particular.
Yes.
So we're really looking at a group of people that still might, and as you point out in another breakdown of the data, would even believe in God. Maybe.
Yes. So the non-religious, the nones, or in this case, the secular in this particular project, can be believers or not believers, but they, the main glue or what keeps them together as a category is the fact that they do not officially belong to a religion.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. And do they, and so then your effort is to try to identify how this group of people that are held together by this idea that they don't have one of the normal recognized religions, have particular social and political views in roughly in common, or at least you can identify some areas of common viewpoint related to social issues or economic issues. What were some of the things that stood out to you as these sort of common ground among the non-religious or among the secular, as you put it? And did any of that surprise you?
So I think the main thing that stuck to me, which I actually did for an op-ed for Friendly Atheist that came out around the week after the survey came out, and it was that the voting patterns, like, so you would expect that the non-religious, at least if you look at the exit polls, which is good for noting voting patterns, but not necessarily voter turnout, which is a whole different can of worms. It's about like 70-30, or has been in that ballpark at least since 2000. Mm. So 70 Democrat, 30 Republican, although it never kind of reaches 30.
Yeah.
And so I did that, but one of the things that you can't really do with exit polls is like look at what issues, especially looking at issues of science or that, you know, kind of like there's the assumption that this community cares about. Because exit polls, like, they don't go that deep into, like, you know, you, essentially you voted for this candidate and then like kind of like how you rank these issues, and this is, you know, like they're done for a different purpose.
Right.
And so I wanted to look at a little bit deeper into, like, you know, this pre-election poll and see where people were at. Although that wasn't generally the purpose of the survey. It's just an election year. And so you have to ask about the election. Otherwise, nobody's going to pay attention to you. And so, you know, I got the 68 to 30 range of 68 voting for Biden, 30 announced that they were going to vote for Trump. People have been emailing me and like leaving message that they're appalled that so many people, and we can get into that breakdown a little later. But, you know, one of the things that I wanted to know, if the secular, you know, the atheist, agnostic, nothing in particular, or all these different labels that I asked that subsample of people, how did they identify as either free thinker, spiritual, but not religious, what issues like click with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the main thing is that everybody is like freaking out about the coronavirus, which is not surprising.
Not surprising.
And that's the main issue, particularly for people who are voting for Biden in this group, are concerned about the coronavirus, healthcare, and the economy. And then this group is also the most likely to care about climate change, which is their fourth main issue.
Okay.
But the main thing I wanted to know in that regard is looking at those issues of science was whether people, you know, there's this assumption that the spiritual but not religious are kind of like into woo and
right.
You know, not really like hardcore secularists. And in fact, like at least in this survey, like that is the case, that there's no much daylight in terms of like the issues that they care. So there's like a coherent pro-science or at least pro-scientific public policy,
right,
cohort of secular people, in regardless of how you identify. So spiritual but not religious are similarly concerned about science that are the atheist agnostic crew. And yeah. I think that is fascinating. And it may have to do with, like, I'll leave it there, because if not, I'll go on into other theories. And
yeah, I mean, I often see Christians in the same kind of category where, you know, they believe that God heals people, for example, like certain Christians do. And yet when they get sick, they go to the doctor, you know, or they might, you know, believe that this earth is made for us to dominate and you know, use for our pleasure, but they might also buy a hybrid car because they're concerned about the environment. So there's all of these contradictions also that exist within ideological groups that don't always make sense on the surface.
Yes, and but for nones, the assumption was that, you know, the spiritual but not religious in particular, because I added that category in there as a label. To see how many people fit in there. And the fascinating was that
a lot.
It was the most popular category.
That's right. Yeah. The all secular, if you group them all together, 47% of agnostics, atheists, and the nothing in particular were identified as spiritual but not religious. They could pick more than one?
Yes, you could pick more than one.
What I got a kick out of.
Nobody picked was secular.
I circled it and wrote haha in the margin. Like only 9% of secular people identify as secular.
Yeah.
That's pretty great. So one of the other really interesting things here that you did, which I haven't seen other reports, and maybe I've just missed it. You have this category or this this graphic asking, like, where you ask folks, do you think that certain people or movements or institutions have changed the country mostly for the better or mostly for the worse? And you broke it out between all Americans as a whole versus secular people. And it was really fascinating. For instance, social media, all Americans and secular people equally 21 percentage points difference towards the negative, that social media has been a negative influence on the country.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is this view that religion, people without religion are a negative effect on the country. 10% of all Americans answered that.
No, so they gave it a minus 10%. So compare, you know, so the difference between those who say mostly for the better or mostly for the worse. So most people said mostly for the worse.
Mostly for the worse by 10% overage, like
yes,
that direction. Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I guess it probably shouldn't surprise me, but that surprised me a little bit. And honestly, like, I expected to see a higher number for secular people, but it was actually pretty low as well, 14% more.
So the question has three categories, which is, do you think the following people, movements, or institutions have changed the country mostly for the better, mostly for the worse, or have not made much difference?
Okay, so there's the and neutral
so, one. Yeah, so there's that big category of mostly, you know, made not much difference.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for the most part, that was in most categories the plurality.
Right.
Unless you have like someone like Barack Obama or Donald Trump that evoke a lot of feelings.
Indeed.
So that means that that category is excluded and just did the difference of better or worse. But that doesn't necessarily mean that on balance, like everybody said, you know, like most people said for the worse. That means in those categories in particular, most people said not much difference.
Right.
And one of the reasons I did this chart that way is that the original chart was like has all the categories plus two, like, you know, all Americans and secular people at the same time. Like, it was way too much to handle.
Right. The other one that I wanted to mention, which I really jumped out at me, was the difference between people's views of immigrants from Europe versus immigrants from Mexico and their influence on society. I mean, just really disheartening. You know, all Americans have a much more negative view of immigrants from Mexico than immigrants from Europe. And again, not that I should be very surprised by this, but to see it in print always takes me a little aback.
Yes, that was a little experiment I wanted to do. So the people who got people from immigrants from Europe didn't get immigrants from Mexico and vice versa. So it was like a split sample.
Oh, interesting.
So because usually if you do something like this, then like especially if you're doing it online, people may be able to get back and like try to fix it.
Oh, true. Go back.
If I say like I want to sound less racist,
I see what he's up to here. So, yeah.
So I decided to leave it. And both samples are similarly demographically, so you can you look at these assumptions but I know you are pretty disheartened by these results, but I would tell you that secular people actually had similar views of both.
Right, exactly.
Immigrants from Mexico and immigrants from Europe. Like, it was, I think, the only group that actually had like, you know, either they're fully racist or not racist, but they certainly have had the... And if you look at, if you look at the racial difference, like white people even higher in terms of like less positive view of immigrant from Mexico than if you slice and dice conservative Republican, and then more positive people from Europe. So, but yeah, the reason I wanted to do it that way is because it's, I've been interested, I mean, for a long time, mostly because, I come from Puerto Rico, my wife is from Mexico, and I'm amazed how Americans love tacos and hate Mexicans.
Right. Yeah. And Cinco de Mayo and
yes. And not only that, like looking at, and I think Robbie mentioned something like this in the episode he was in of your podcast, which is that, people have these, at least on paper, have these positive views of immigrants. And then when you ask deeper, like they have these really racist notions.
Right. Right. Yeah. If you ask them, are you a racist? They're going to say no. If you say
exactly.
Like...
But and then like people are very positive toward immigrants, but then they don't really like to make life easier for immigrants.
Right. Exactly.
And
it's like Black Lives Matter, but we're not going to do anything to make Black lives more important.
Yes. And so it was a way of looking at, how people look at immigration from two perspectives and see, like, rather than looking at how they look at immigrants changing the country for the better.
Right. Well, speaking of policy issues, you did ask them, your participants lots of different questions about various policy positions and broke them down again by all Americans versus secular Americans. And there wasn't that much difference on progressive policy issues, expanding healthcare access to all Americans. 77% of all Americans ranked that as important, which I think matches other studies I've seen or other statistics I've seen in the news that Medicare for all or some version of Medicare for all is actually, 3/4 of Americans would like to see this. 85% of all secular identifying people would like to see access to healthcare expanded to everyone. A little bit more on climate change, a little bit there. The secular folks are just a little bit more favorable towards these policies than others, except for removing the phrase under God from the Pledge of Allegiance. That there's a pretty stark difference there.
Yes. Yes, those are which. But the other thing that is interesting is that even in removing the Pledge of Allegiance, under God from the Pledge of Allegiance, it's only 49%.
It's only, yeah, right.
And it's the lowest ranking one.
Yeah.
So it's the only, like, really, well, I mean, removing exemptions to vaccinations, like religious exemptions to vaccination, is kind of like a church state issue, but like the most obvious church state issue is the one that kind of like ranks the lower among secular folk.
Yeah. I mean, thankfully, also kind of a symbolic thing. Like, nobody's going to die from the word under God being in the Pledge of Allegiance. It's a bit annoying, but it's more symbolic in my view, at least. What's really encouraging is that these things poll in the 70% range, expanding healthcare, investing in renewable energy to address climate change, increasing and expanding government aid for people who need it, tuition-free public colleges, increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour, universal basic income even, 65% of all Americans favor $1,000 a month for all adults and 75% of the secular folks. So, I mean, these are pretty progressive policies by American standards, and all polling quite well. You'd never know it from the political debate that we're currently having.
Yes, and I think the other aspect is to what extent a lot of these economic ideas are just, you know, the coronavirus crisis is just like making people rethink that.
I agree with that, yeah.
Because it's people without jobs, without like a steady income. So these policy ideas start becoming a little bit more interesting and you know, necessary. And you're right, like, you know, the discourse doesn't capture that. But I mean, it's been a while in which like American public opinion and American policymaking have diverged in a way.
Unbelievable. Yeah, you would. Yeah, if you compare like the 538 elected members of Congress and polled them on these things, you would see that, right? Like you would see the difference. And they're not maybe voting, you know, if you could give them a pill that would only allow them to answer the questions based on what they personally would like to see for themselves and their family, you know, versus what will keep them in office and all the political considerations, you know, you might get a different answer as well. But yeah, it's wild. And I keep thinking that more politicians that would just run honestly on progressive causes like Bernie Sanders did, or like AOC, who's just, you know, boldly out there saying, you know, we need Medicare for all. That's my platform. And lo and behold, it's wildly popular, you know, instead of this cautious, like, we can't say that. That'll be too progressive. Nobody will vote for us. Maybe they will, you know, if you, you know, put out a really intelligent view about it.
Yeah. And, you know, going a little bit off track, but going in that same vein, I think another issue, which is something that I want to do after I move a little bit from secular public opinion, going more into secular representation in politics, which is, I think it's another subject that, you know, it's very undercovered.
Right.
But going into political representation, I think one of the aspects, you know, I work at Demos before I founded Socioanalytica as a senior policy analyst and did work on money in politics. And there's this dearth of politicians who come from working class backgrounds.
Yep.
And whether like how much that, you know, how the background and the economic conditions of the politicians actually matter in terms of policy making. It's not something we talk a lot. And I'll have a name for you at the end so we can.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think
for
that's
an interview that.
That's hugely interesting to me. Yeah, representation not only of secular people in politics, because I think in the secular community, that's the type of representation we're usually talking about. And in the wider culture, of course, we're looking at the representation of women and people of color in elected offices. We've seen a good wave of new, younger, that's another representation, younger people of color,
yes.
Women, you know, and also non-religious people. But what you're also suggesting is this economic factor, which is the working class perspective. I just watched finally the documentary Knocking Down the House. It's been in my queue on Netflix for a long time. And, you know, all of those candidates that they cover, the four candidates that they cover in that documentary, including AOC, you know, all say, maybe no one more eloquently than the woman from Kentucky, from Appalachia, you know, this district needs to be represented by people who understand the conditions that people are living in here, you know, and, you know, they haven't yet won their office, but, with the exception of AOC, and it looks like Cori Bush now looking at a victory in Missouri's first district, and, Jamal Brown in New York, and AOC will be reelected. And so will the other members of the so-called squad. But, yeah, so I think things are changing, but that working class background would be such a delight to see. In our, you know, too many lawyers, too many Ivy League degrees. Nothing wrong with having an Ivy League degree. Sometimes I wish I had one, but it doesn't really matter that much, you know, in everyday life, does it?
Not really. But and it also tells you about, you know, how close these networks are.
Yes, yes.
You know, and who can run for office or who is seen as someone who can run for office. One of the amazing things is like, what makes a candidate like a serious candidate, especially for the president? It can raise money.
That's it. Yep.
It's not like, you know, has like a constituency or anything like that. No,
or a coherent political ideology that will, you know, benefit the community. One of the things I wanted to mention here briefly about policy, I mean, you ask a range of questions, policy questions that are, as you said, in a cluster of economic issues. I've noticed in the secular community this real tendency to steer away from economic issues as divisive. You know, we can agree on separation of church and state, strictly speaking, issues of equality, cultural issues around equality, LGBTQ equality, women's equality, you know, equality for trans people specifically, et cetera. But when it comes to some of these issues around like Medicare for all or free public college or minimum wage, it's a little harder to get the secular community specifically to see those as secular issues. But what you're identifying here is that they are secular issues. I mean, they're issues that secular people care about.
Yes, absolutely. How I phrased it sounding like diplomatic. I've been enough enough time. I've been a professional lefty, meaning that I've been working for professional progressive organizations, whether as an employee or as a contractor.
Yeah.
And you know, the secular movement in many ways is not different in the case that it has a lot of progressive people, but the disconnect between donors to organizations and members of organizations is amazing.
Right, right.
And so to some extent is how much you can focus on in terms of like, you know, what funding you get for.
Yeah, and how you'll scare away.
My other experience have been, especially in DC, has been that there's a lot of progressive secular people who are not secular movement people.
Right.
And so they are, you know, their secular identity is not their main thing. So they, you know, they work for the Sierra Club, or they work for Demos, or they work for like Public Citizen or organizations like that, but not necessarily like have an AHA or a CFI or a FFRF membership.
Right.
And they don't see themselves as members of those communities.
Mm.
And it's to our detriment, because there's a lot of professional experience in there of people who, you know, who can be very good to our movement in the sense of giving it some expertise that we sorely lack.
How can we get more of those folks to see our movement as something that they should be a part of?
I mean, in my anecdotal, I don't have data on this. So this is like my anecdotes of talking to people, trying them to join, sometimes successfully, most times unsuccessfully. I think it has a lot to do with people not seeing us as a movement of church and state issues, and they don't really care about that.
Yeah.
Really not care about that. And in general, like, you know, not thinking that, you know, this is not organized in the way that, you know, at least they say it, and they're not really organized in the way that it's conductive to the kind of movements that they want to build.
Right. Yeah. I do think that sometimes the church and state dialogue comes off as abstract. You know, it's the same way that, you know, other constitutional arguments often, you know, constitutional arguments have real world consequences, of course, and that's what really concerns people. But sometimes when we get into those discussions, it, you know, it gets very esoteric and very abstract pretty quickly. And people are like, look, I can't put food on my table. I can't pay my rent. And you want me to worry about, you know, a phrase in the Pledge of Allegiance. Like, I just, you know, I don't have time for that.
And that's what the survey shows, right? Economic issues, especially as economic inequality increases, like people are not really care about I wouldn't call it esoteric. That was, you know, like I'll use a phrase from Ronald Inglehart and say like postmodern kind of issues.
Don't identify that way.
But or in essentially first world problems. To a large extent. And
I don't think it's aesthetic. I don't think it's merely about window dressings. I think they are substantive conversations, but it's sort of like, you know, I'm deeply involved in the homelessness, anti-homelessness and renters' rights movement here in Los Angeles and my city of Pasadena, and talking to people about housing policy. It's just so dense and arcane, and we're constantly trying to figure out how to lift up the principles, you know, so that, or even just any anti-capitalist discourse, you know, people like anti-capitalist, like they can't even imagine what that would be like, you know, like as Mark Fisher said, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism.
But, you know, going into that same line, like one of the, when I was at Demos, I was working on money in politics, which is esoteric as you get.
Right.
Like, and so, you know, the aspect that we were working on, it was making into a more populist issue, like, and seeing helping people see the connection of, you know, like elected officials raising insane amounts of money and not being accountable. Right. And I think like on some level, people think about it, but most of the frame is about corruption. And when you talk people about corruption, they just turn off, and it's talking to them, like shifting the narrative into something that, you know, empowering them and like removing the issue, like restricting the issue, like restricting the flow of money, using these reforms to actually be able to do progressive policymaking and not having like, you know, the boogie co-brothers like block everything in the way.
Right.
And I think we need to even separation of church and state doesn't have to be esoteric in that way. I mean, we can connect in the ways in which, like, you know, like all these subsidies to churches are detrimental to like, you know, funding for schools and like, you know, tax breaks and all these kind of stuff.
Public health
that
agencies.
That affects people in a real way.
Yeah. Let's get into, before this goes so long that people stop listening to us, which is always a real concern, but I'm having fun. So you mentioned much earlier in the show that, you found that there were among secular people about 30% who were going to vote for Donald Trump and about 68% that were going to vote for Joe Biden. I wonder if you would like drill down into that a little bit more and, you know, help us understand who are the secular people who want to vote for Donald Trump. Because I think the picture of the Donald Trump administration for 4 years. I mean, 4 years ago, it was an unknown and people maybe voted because they just wanted to shake things up or he was a businessman and we needed a business person to run the country. Now we have 4 years of evidence of, you know, the way that he is and his, you know, the Muslim ban, you know, anti-religious kind of thing. And then the ways that he has stacked his cabinet with, you know, people like Betsy DeVos and others who wish to and the way he's selected Supreme Court justices to pick something super recent. Who are the non-religious who are really excited about Donald Trump?
So they identify as conservative, not surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care much about science, but they are not necessarily that nothing in particular is kind of spiritual, but not religious. So it's this really interesting cohort and, you know, just looking at those issues, that are in the survey, it gives you a sense like, you know, so there's this conservative cohort that has always been around. So if you look at the voting patterns of the knowns, like it never reaches 30%. So, you know, of course this survey was taken in September before the debates. And so who knows what the number is right now. PRI has like 74-22 in a survey that they did in October. So it's still within the margin of error of this survey.
That's good.
So it's still within that range. So it may be that it will get lower. It may be that it will get higher, but certainly there's a conservative cohort within the secular movement that has been always there. I mean, most people call them libertarians.
Oh yeah, right.
I think one aspect in there is, and if you look at the known vote over time, which I did kind of like in the inaugural column of my non-decision 2020 that I did for The Humanist, you know, there's these long vote or this history of voting disproportionately for third party candidates.
Oh, right.
And given that there's no real like third party candidate right now that is catching attention, whether like Gary Johnson or Jill Stein in 2016, that a lot of those people are coming home, you know, like conservative leaning libertarian people are flocking to Donald Trump. After all, like, you know, he's deregulating the environment.
That's right. As recently as today.
These are people who don't really care much about climate change. And so you know, there's aspects of libertarians actually, you know, they may not like the like overly religious aspect of Trump presidency, at least the pandering to the religious right, but they do like the deregulation of environmental things and tax cuts and the white supremacy. I mean, that cannot be understated.
Right.
The white supremacy runs strong in the movement.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And so that may explain part of it. There were no explicit questions about white supremacy. But certainly, if you look at attitudes toward immigration and attitudes toward like children, and you look at attitudes toward the environment, you start seeing a picture of like people who don't care much about Black Lives Matter, don't care much about race, don't care much about Me Too either, and that you know, it's heavily male and white.
Yeah, yeah. There's this organization, I'm sure you've seen, Republican Atheists. I don't think they have much traction. They try to make a little noise on social media. And it's just been so puzzling to, like, even the Brandenburg Cross lawsuit that the American Humanist Association brought against, I guess, the veterans of foreign wars and the state of Maryland or something. I forget who the defendants were, but... you know, and again,
it was
largely,
the town of Brandenburg, which is not far from where I live.
Right, exactly. Like the town of Brandenburg, yeah. And again, a largely symbolic case, no real material concerns of people's lives embedded in there. You know, and I saw, you know, Republican atheists and some other conservative atheists basically siding with the Christians, you know, saying that this is a violation of, you know, of history and veterans, concerns for veterans and that sort of thing. So I think there is kind of an Americanism, which is kind of white, male, libertarian. I often identified when I was doing my year without God, and I was really surprised by this libertarian streak within atheism. And it hit me, and this is a crude analysis, but it sort of hit me one day that when you give up on God, it's sort of like, I don't want this God bossing me around anymore. Like, I don't believe he exists, and I've been living under this fake person's rule for all of my life. So forget about him. And furthermore, nobody's going to tell me what to do anymore. You know, if you've lived under a regime of, you know, people telling you what to do all the time, i.e. religion, might be easy to jettison all limitations on your alleged freedom. I've also challenged a few libertarians to show me a cohort of poor libertarians, and I'm still waiting for that revelation.
That's kind of like the $1 million
challenge,
James Randi challenge.
That's right. Yeah, $1 million challenge. Show me like a sizable cohort. I don't know what the number would be of, you know, poor by American demographic standards, identifying as libertarian. It's sort of the I got mine philosophy. Well, let's do a quick lightning round here. And this is where I, you know, I'm going to do the thing I'm sure you hate, which is I'm going to assume that as a researcher and a data analyst, that you also can predict the future.
No.
So let's do this. Let's do some predictions, shall we? Can you go?
Okay. I just hope that James Randi doesn't show up tonight
in your dreams.
Yes.
Well, we know that we're just joking, but so what do you predict for the presidential election?
I mean, if the polls are right, and I trust the polls because
you're a pollster.
And you know, I know a lot of the people who work in the field, and you know, they're serious people, and they really care about getting it right.
Yeah.
So you know, you should expect, barring any legal shenanigans, that Joe Biden should win. How big a win? Anybody's guess.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think it's pretty clear that I think when I was going into the election, as we were getting into 2020, it wasn't clear to me to what extent people really don't like Donald Trump. Like, and even if we look at the narrative that we have for elections, like Donald Trump lost the popular vote. Like most people don't like Donald Trump. Right. And if the reverse had been true, like let's say Hillary had won by 170,000 votes in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, we would be talking about how the country rejected racism.
Right.
With the numbers not really changing that much. But what has become clear is that there's very few undecideds. Like, there's no movement that can happen. I mean, there was a possibility that happened when Trump won, that, you know, there was so many undecideds that they will break for him. And that was essentially what happened. But this is not the case. There's no people to peel off. And like with so many people voting early, there's not much that can happen within
5 days.
Today and election day.
Yeah. The New York Times reported, I think yesterday, that there was no bump either direction from the last debate. Like it didn't move anyone anywhere.
So, yeah. So I think barring shenanigans, Biden should win.
Yeah. And what are the chances you think that there would be some serious shenanigans on the order of what we've read, like in that Atlantic article that was so popular a month ago or so about like serious, where a governor would throw out all the electors and assign electors, you know, the way that he or she wants them to go?
You know, I mean, that's definitely a possibility. This is going to be probable. I'm not sure. To a large extent, like if you still want to call yourself, you know, if you want to still be on good standing in the world as a leader, like that is, you know, that is outright stealing an election and popular
there's
will.
Some
so
global peer pressure.
I don't think that's something that could happen. Like, you know, there's still, you know, there's some face still to save when you talk about being a democratic country.
That's encouraging to hear. You know, that's something to hold on to. There's still some face left to save.
But what do I know? Like, you know, but at the same time, like, you know, these people don't surprise me anymore.
What about the Senate? What are the chances you think the Democrats take control of the Senate?
I'm still a skeptical. Like, I see people, like, you know, I see 538 now says that it's likely that they're going to win the Senate. I'm skeptical mostly because of where the seats are.
Mm-hmm.
That North Carolina seat, I think it's doable, but I mean, who knows what the Republicans are going to do in there. And then Georgia is a whole different kind of worms. So I think it's doable. It may end up 50-50 with Kamala Harris being the deciding vote. But I wouldn't bet on a large majority, although I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, yeah. And what do you think the chances are, let's say Biden wins the election and the Senate tips ever so slightly to the Democrat side and we expand a little bit our hold on the House, that a Biden administration in the first 2-3 years, you know, really does some progressive things like address the inequality of the or the undemocratic nature of the Electoral College or add Supreme Court justices to the court. Do you see, you know, some progressive moves coming from a Biden administration with a mandate?
I think probably the most progressive thing we're going to see right away, if something happens like that, it's like trying to pass an aid package.
Oh, coronavirus, yeah.
Nobody's going to get. So I think that's going to be the first order of the day.
Yeah.
Trying to get some economic aid. And then on, like, you know, the courts is interesting because, you know, I'm not sure Biden is for it.
Yeah.
Even publicly, like, you know, I think a lot of the stuff that people, you know, these candidates say publicly is like,
yeah, who knows?
Either trying not to, you know, you're not trying to freak out, like, you know, you have a steady lead, you haven't done anything, like, why do you wanna mess with it?
Right.
I mean, essentially, if you say you are for it, you're not gonna add voters.
So what are you gonna change?
But I think a few things could happen. Personally, I would like to see the House of Representatives expanded. That's the best way of dealing with the Electoral College, because you live in California, you have the largest delegation and still underrepresented. And so, you know, like the Electoral College, one easy fix rather than like going through an amendment, it's essentially like expanding the House. You know, people talk about adding Guam and Puerto Rico as states. No, as a Puerto Rican, like, you know, like you're just going colonial again.
Right.
But, you know, why don't you ask Puerto Ricans if they want to be a state, but actually for real this time, not like with those, like, you know, those crappy polls that the pro-statehood party throws every 2 years or so.
Right.
So, you know, a Congress-backed plan to respect results. Don't make Puerto Rico a state just because, like, because you may even be surprised. You have no idea how much power Pentecostals have in there.
That's right. Yeah, it's so utilitarian to, like, oh, we need more political power in the United States. Let's make Puerto Rico a state. Like,
yes. But the Supreme Court, I'm not sure if it will happen, but I think the things had gotten so bad that it's a good persuasion. And it may even be a good persuasion in the, like, FDR kind of way, which, like, you know, freak out the Republicans and the Supreme Court enough to get the New Deal stuff passing, passing constitutional muster. I have a friend from grad school who is a constitutional scholar, and I ask him, can we just get rid of judicial review? And he's like, yeah, that's pretty easy.
Right.
So, I mean,
you can also just ignore it.
Review is, it's one. And just don't care. But I think the other aspect of these is the sense of how we progressives, and, you know, in liberals in particular, have been looking at the courts. And people just remember the Warren and Burger courts as, like, you know, being the epitome of the Supreme Court. But historically, the Supreme Court hasn't been helpful to progressive causes. And so we're just regressing to the mean. And we have to, you know, it's only for a small time period of time in the United States history where progressives weren't fighting the Supreme Court and were defending it.
Yeah.
And so we just got to learn that history back.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. There's so many undemocratic features of the American Constitution and American jurisprudence. And it's just really disheartening. I mean, the Senate is a great example as well. Like, you talked about expanding the House, but the Senate is the most undemocratic institution, maybe other than the Supreme Court. It's like 2/3 of the government.
The Supreme Court is not. I mean, it's not technically a bad constitutional thing, with the exception of judicial review, because once you're binding yourself to it, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just, you know, making these decisions, solving conflict between, particularly between states,
right.
But not necessarily deciding what the Constitution means.
Yeah. Well, thanks for spending this time with us. Thank you for the work that you're doing. And we'll see if your predictions come true in a few days.
Thank you for the opportunity. I've been looking forward to do this. We've been talking for a while, and I'm glad that it worked out finally.
Thanks for listening. This was a little longer than usual, so congrats if you've made it this far. We are absolutely leaving behind one of the most intensely harmful U.S. presidencies in modern times, certainly the most grotesquely hateful. And we're turning the page to a new set of opportunities and challenges. Celebrate this victory if you like. Allow yourself to feel good about the refusal of more Trumpism. And then let's get back to working for the humanist vision of planetary thriving. Until next time, my name is Ryan Bell, and this has been the Life After God podcast.